From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Dorothy Beam's son Joe died of AIDS 3 years ago as he was working on his second anthology of gay black writing. After his death, Dorothy decided that she could finish that collection. On this edition of Fresh Air, Dorothy Beam talks with us about continuing her son's work. Also today, we meet the creator of that tough-as-nails private eye, V.I. Warshawski. Detective writer Sarah Paretsky has just finished her seventh V.I. novel, and it's called Guardian Angel. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book that's a big hit on college campuses, a guide on how to cheat on exams. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate met behind closed doors today to review intelligence information about China's arms sales to the Middle East. The session was called by lawmakers just prior to passage of legislation that attaches conditions to the renewal of most favored nation trade status for China. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Last week, the CIA gave members of Congress evidence that China has shipped $250 million worth of missiles, nuclear technology, and other goods to Syria, Libya, Iran, Iraq, and Pakistan. Lawmakers requested an additional briefing today as they prepared to vote to continue China's trading status. The legislation passed by a vote of 59-39. It would require China to make significant progress in the areas of human rights, trade, and weapons proliferation. Although the bill was expected to pass, its supporters did not have enough votes to override a certain presidential veto. The administration argues that isolating China would hamper efforts to influence its policies. But citing China's trade surplus with the United States, human rights violations, and weapons proliferation, Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell said today no nation has done more to make China's behavior appear respectable than the United States. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
Reports from China say that seven dissidents were sentenced to prison today for pro-democracy activities. The dissidents include an editor at the Communist Party newspaper who was sentenced to 4 years in prison for helping to issue a pro-democracy leaflet during the Tiananmen Square uprising in 1989. A Beijing University student leader was sentenced to 2 years for pro-democracy activity in 1990. The Associated Press said the sentences were reported by Chinese sources. There was no mention of the sentences in China's official news media. Iraq has indicated that it might cooperate with United Nations efforts to monitor its weapons production, but it suggested that the UN should respond by lifting some of the economic sanctions against the country. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
UN officials want to monitor Iraq's industries to ensure that they are producing no more weapons of mass destruction. But officials say Iraq has tried to obstruct the work. Last week, the Security Council warned Iraq it would face serious consequences if it didn't cooperate with UN inspectors. In a letter circulated today, Iraqi Foreign Minister Ahmed Hussein said Baghdad did not reject weapons monitoring by the UN, but he said there should be a fair balance between Iraqi compliance and the lifting of economic sanctions. The letter appeared to some officials to be an attempt by Iraq to set conditions for compliance, a position certain to be rejected by the U.S. and its allies. A delegation of high-level Iraqi officials is expected to travel to the UN in New York next month to discuss these issues. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 25 points today to close at 3,257. This is NPR. The Supreme Court ruled today that the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment may extend to prison guards who use unnecessary force against inmates. The 7-2 decision said that guards may not use excessive force against their prisoners, even if the force doesn't result in significant injuries. The decision was written by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who said that when prison officials maliciously and sadistically use force to cause harm, contemporary standards of decency always are violated. President Bush kicked off a week-long six-city campaign swing through Texas, Georgia, and California today. The president went to California first, where some advisors fear Republican primary challenger Patrick Buchanan may have wide support. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
There's no mystery as to why Mr. Bush is trying to get an early jump in California. With its 54 electoral votes, one-fifth of the total needed to win re-election, the president can barely afford to lose the state in November. Add to that the worry among some Republican strategists that the president is in trouble here. The real estate and aerospace industries are depressed. The state GOP is at odds with itself over Governor Pete Wilson's performance thus far, and polls show that only 38% of Californians are inclined to re-elect Mr. Bush. That's down from 54% 6 months ago. Aboard Air Force One today, Mr. Bush seemed to shrug off his problems.
Just go about our game plan, which is to take our message out there. Understand there's two extraordinarily successful fundraisers in place out there, so that should say something.
The Bush campaign expects to raise $2 million today in California. The Bushes will also visit former President Ronald Reagan in Los Angeles. I'm Richard Gonzalez with the president in San Francisco.
As the president spoke today at a $1,000 a plate luncheon in San Francisco, about 1,500 AIDS activists protested outside. At least 15 of the demonstrators were arrested, including 9 who chained themselves to furniture in the hotel lobby. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Joe Beam was a black gay writer. In 1986, he published the first anthology of black gay writing called In the Life. He was at work on a second edition when he died of AIDS in 1988. He was 33 at the time. The book didn't end with Joe's death because after he died, his mother, Dorothy Beam, did an exceptional thing. She picked up where Joe left off. With the help of poet Essex Hempel, she finished the book. It's called Brother to Brother. Dorothy Beam and her husband Sonny live in Philadelphia, just west of the downtown Center City section where Joe lived and worked. We invited Dorothy Beam on to talk with us about the book and how her life has changed since its publication. She told me how she first learned her son was gay.
Well, it came out of a clear blue sky, to be honest, because we didn't know. I was very naive about gays and lesbians. In fact, I didn't know anything about it. And my son had come in from college, and he said, "Dad, Mom, I want to talk to you." And he said, "Well, I'm gay."
Just as simple as that.
Oh, yeah. He just came right out with it. And well, how can you polish it up? So I was taken aback. But I said to him, "Joe, if you had been a lawyer, I would love you. If you'd have been a doctor, I'd love you." I said, "I'll love you even more that you're gay, because you're going to need a lot of support, an awful lot of support."
And were you concerned about the kind of life that he would have, or the kind of life that he was having?
I was terrified, because I had heard enough to know there was a great deal of gay bashing going on. And I know it's a cruel world out there. And I told him, you know, he's an African male, which is two strikes. Being gay is a triple whammy. That's what I referred to it as, a triple whammy. Not at that time. Later on, I referred to it as a triple whammy. The only thing, after he talked to my husband and I, and he had left the room to go out, my husband didn't feel quite the same way I felt about it. In fact, he still can't accept it. That's why he's not here with me. He doesn't go anywhere with me. And we talked about it. He said that he can't handle it. And he gives me this story. My father wasn't gay, and my grandfather wasn't gay, and I don't know if anybody in my family was gay. I said, "Well, I don't either. But we have this gay child here. We've got to support him."
Were you literally able to accept it right off the bat? Or was
right
it
off the bat. No, right. As soon as my son told me, there were no ifs, ands, or buts about it, I put my arms around him. I told him it was all right. We would work this thing out together, and whatever he wanted to do, it was all right with me. See, I can't stand around and say to him, "Well, your mother, your father, and I got married, and that's the way it's supposed to be," because when I brought him in the world, I didn't know what he was going to be. I took my chances like everybody else. Just so happens I had a gay son. Yes.
Did you hide the fact at all from your friends and family? Was this an issue that you wanted to keep within your family?
Oh, no. I told everybody that I could think of. I took him everywhere that I ever went. Oh, no. And this is what most people could not understand. My acceptance. They just marveled at it, how I accepted. I said, "What? This is my child. You know, if he was born with one arm, I would accept him. If he was born blind, I would lead him around. This is my son."
You talked about the difficulty of being a gay black man.
Yes.
In this country.
Yes.
What were your then greatest fears for him?
Somebody would hurt him. It bothered me all the time. And I used to say to him, Joe, when he finally moved from the apartment building in Overbrook, I said, Joe, be careful how you go out at night. Don't go out alone. Two or three of you go together. Because there was always somebody out to get him. Not just him, any gay or lesbian person. I said, it's better to go to the gay bar. Some of the gay bars, I went with him. I went with him to the gay restaurants. I went with him to the gay bars because I was not ashamed.
And did he like having you there?
Oh, my goodness, yes, yes, yes. I went with him. In fact, a lot of places that I go, and even now, I don't, because I've only been to one since that time to give a girl some information, but they remember me. They said, oh, yes, Mrs. Mew, I remember when you used to come with Joe. I said, yeah. Well, see, because I wasn't ashamed. So I went with him. When his book came out for his first reading at Giovanni's room, his dad went there. And that's when I found out how his father really felt. Because when we came back that evening, he talked to me about it. He said, I'm not going through this again. He really.
Is there anything you could say you think to change your husband's mind?
Oh, no, I can't tell you to change his mind. In fact, I wouldn't know what to say to change his mind. In fact, he says to me even now, he said, I don't know how you can go all these places, how you can be a part of all this. He said, your son has passed. Let it drop. I said, I can't let it drop because my son really died for this book. He worked so hard. He put so much into it. This is a legacy to my son. So I'm working every day. Every day I do something.
When did you find out your son had AIDS?
Oh, now that was a real surprise. I noticed that when Joe came around to the house, to me, he was getting thin. He said, oh, Mom, you always worry. I'm not getting thin. I said, are you eating enough? And one of the things that we did every time we met in town accidentally or by arrangement, I took him out to eat because he was so thin. And then another thing, he was always so tired. And I said, Sonny, I don't know why Joe is always so tired. He felt tired and he required a lot of sleep. And I knew I figured he was using a lot of energy in the book and he was working at Salad Dally. I figured he's working, he's writing a book, and this is why he was so tired. I did not know he had AIDS.
So when did you actually find out he had
AIDS? I didn't find out until after Joe died and the coroners called me and told me that, because we went down to the coroner's office, and my sister and I, and he explained to me what the problem was and why we couldn't see the body and the whole bit. They went through the whole bit with it.
Why do you think your son kept that information from you?
Because my son knew that if I knew that he had AIDS, I would have immediately wanted him to come home. He would have had to give up the apartment. He would have to come home, and I would have to take care of him. And he did not want to do that. He was very independent. And then knowing that I'm a worrywart, if he had told me and remained in Center City, I would have gone crazy. I would have been there practically every day.
I hesitate to ask you this question, but I think it's an important one. Is it possible to describe what it was like to lose your only child?
Oh, it was devastating. When they called me and told me about my son, the landlord where he lived, they called me and told me, well, he said, Miss Beam, I want you to sit down. He said, Joe, we don't think Joe is not well. And I had the police over there because we had to go into the apartment. He said, I'll call you back. He must have called me back in 2 minutes. He said, well, the police were there and they found Joe dead. I said, okay. Thank you. I said, I'll get back in touch. So he gave me the number and right away I called my sister. My sister's the one that starts screaming and hollering. I didn't start to scream. I said to her, Margaret, please, I need your help. Don't go to pieces. So I got myself together, and when my sister came, she has a car, and we immediately started to get things rolling. I was fine all the time. I was getting out the cards all the time that I had the memorial services. Everything went beautiful. I didn't collapse until after everything was over, and I went to pieces. I had to have medical care. Mm-hmm. I had to go to my psychiatrist, the whole bit, because I had held it all within me, and my face broke all out. I had to go to dermatologist. In fact, when I went, I had to wear a cloth or scarf over my head because my face was so bad, I couldn't show my face in public. I had to stay home because I couldn't go out, and my nerves were shot to pieces. I couldn't sleep. It seems to me that I was awake all the time. And when I would try to go to sleep, I couldn't. I couldn't go to sleep. And my husband said, well, you will just have to try to get yourself together. Mm-hmm. I said, no. So for a whole year, I was in there, and I was suffering on the inside. But when somebody would call up, I'd try to, how are you doing? Oh, I'm doing well. But I was so sick, and my hands were all broke out. It was nerves, and the emotion was coming out in my skin. And the only thing I could do was eat, which was the worst thing. But it was like a nervous, I was just constantly eating all the time.
Tell me what it was like for you to begin to go through your son's manuscripts, his letters, his photographs, the things that he kept, which then became part of this second anthology of Black gay writing.
That was really a traumatic experience. And my husband was there with me, and well, it took us a couple of weeks, because I had to go through everything and read through. And the more I read, the worse I kept feeling. And then the depression sets in all over again. And I'd have to read some days, and then I'd have to put the folders away, and then I'd have to go back again.
What made you decide that you wanted to complete what your son had started, which was a second anthology of Black gay writing? What made you think that you could do this?
Well, at first, I didn't think I could do it. That's why I enlisted the help of Essex Hemphill. I'm not a writer, so I said, I have to get someone who I have a feeling that can do the job. And the way I got a hold of Essex was by going through the papers, because as I went through the papers, he and my son had corresponded a lot. I mean, a lot. And Joe had some of Essex poetry in there. And the rhythm and the letters, the intent of the letters told me that they had a very good relationship going. Then on top of that, when Joe used to go to Washington, he used to stay with Essex. He said, Mother, I stayed with Essex Hemphill. Well, I didn't know Essex Hemphill from anybody, but I remember him saying I stayed at Essex apartment while I was in Washington.
And Essex Hemphill is the editor of this second anthology.
Yes.
You and he then worked together.
We worked together. He lived at my house for 2 years, almost 3 years, and we finished it.
Would you call him your second son?
Well, that's what my husband used to say to me all the time. He said, you really treat Essex like he's your son, and he's got a mother. I don't think his mother's going to like this. Yeah, he used to tell me all the time that he didn't think Essex's mother would like this, that you're trying to take her son away from her. I said, well, no, I'm not really trying to take her son away from her. I said, but Essex has been a help. If it hadn't been for Essex, I wouldn't have known who to get. I didn't know who. If I hadn't gone through the papers, I wouldn't have known, because I didn't know all my son's friends. I was lucky to get Essex.
I want to take a short break, and let me just reintroduce you. And I'm speaking today with Dorothy Beam, and she's a retired Philadelphia guidance counselor. And we're talking about her son, Joe Beam, who died 3 years ago. He was a writer, and before he died, was in the process of editing his second anthology of Black gay writing. Dorothy Beam continued his work along with Essex Hemphill, and now Brother to Brother is out and it's published. And Joe Beam's first anthology of Black gay writing is called In the Life. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Dorothy Beam, and we're talking about her son, Joe Beam, who was a writer, and about the work that she has continued, and this is his work that she has continued. She was involved in the editing of a second anthology of Black gay writing. I must ask you, looking through this anthology, which I did, what it was like for you to read some of these essays, some of these very personal stories, some of them very sexually graphic. Mm. And as a mother, looking into, I guess, a life that your son must have left, had led, what was that like for you?
Well, I'll tell you, it was an educational experience, because some of the things that I read about in those books, I didn't even know it happened in the world. I mean, it was like an eye-opener. And then after I read it, I was glad I wrote it, because I feel if we don't know what's going on the other side of the mountain, then we can't help those people. So in reading the books, I have learned a lot that in my wildest dreams I would have never known, because I would, if I had talked to someone, they would not have talked that explicit to me. First thing, I'm an older person, and then being a female, they would have held back. But in writing the book, they came out with their knowledge and their sorrows and their joys, and they were very pacific about it. So through that, I learned a lot.
So you were not shocked?
Oh, no. I wasn't shocked. I was shocked that I didn't know more about what was going on in the gay community. I felt, as I told a couple people, it was a learning experience for me. I didn't even know all these things went on. Oh, my God. I said, I can't believe this. But the things that they wrote about were true and factual, and it was an education. I would have never gotten it other than through Brother the Brother, because I wouldn't pick up those books and read them ordinarily.
Well, I must tell you that I'm absolutely amazed by your open-mindedness, because I think many parents, it doesn't matter whether their children were straight or gay, wouldn't necessarily want to know the kind of sexual activities that they were involved in, or some of the deep, darker side of their personal life.
Well, I didn't want to know it. I wouldn't have gone out. I wouldn't have gone out and purchased Brother the Brother if my son hadn't been gay. But because my son was gay, I had to know what's going on in the gay world. And that was the only way I could find out, is by reading the book. Otherwise, I would have never known all the things that happen in the gay community. But I'm better off for knowing. I'm better off for knowing the troubles, the trials, and the tribulations. And I'm better off for knowing what their sexual desires are, because now that it's necessary for everyone to practice safe sex. How can you practice safe sex if you don't know what they're doing? This way, if you say to someone, practice safe sex, you know what you're talking about. So it was a revelation and an education for me. And Brother the Brother, when I tell people about it, I said, listen, there are a lot of uncomfortable things in there. But it's only through this discomfort that you're going to learn the same way I learned.
Here you are. You're in your 60s. You've retired from...
Yes, I'm 68 today. It's my birthday.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
That's great.
Yes.
Did you think that this is what your retirement was going to be like?
No. I said to my husband, when I retire, we're going to go to Las Vegas. We're going to go to the Bahamas. And we're just going to travel around, because I've never been out of the country. He says, a good idea. But it was not in the cards. I can't travel around unless I travel around for the books. But you see, out of this experience, I'm getting a lot. I'm meeting a lot of people. There are people that I have met that, under ordinary circumstances, I would have never met them, because I wouldn't have been in that particular company. So I have met a lot of fine people.
Do you feel then you're a part of the gay and lesbian community?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. In fact, I get calls every day from somebody that needs some kind of advice, somebody that needs help, just someone to talk to. And they feel that they can talk to me because I understand. Perhaps they can't even, many of them can't talk to their own parents. But they know, well, if I call Miss Beam, I can talk to her and she will understand. Because I've been through this. I had a gay son. So I know what they're going through. And then the book helped me to understand the many things, the fears that they have.
Have you been surprised to discover who your son was? And I'm thinking about the kind of contact and the kind of community that he was involved in, but also the effect that he had on the world. Here in Philadelphia, there was a Joe Beam Day.
Yeah.
There are libraries that are interested in his work. Does that surprise you?
It took me by surprise. In fact, the whole business took me by surprise, because I knew my son knew a lot of people, but I did not know he knew thousands. He had a small file box. It must have been 3,000 addresses in there. And when the ladies came down, the gay people came to help me with all the writing, they could not believe. The box was about, I guess, 10 or 12 inches. It was like a little file box. And it had nothing but 3x5 cards in there from everywhere in the United States and out of the country. I was overwhelmed. I could not believe that my son knew all these people. And then I could not believe that they knew him. And as I was in Reading Terminal, and I give out the papers about my son. And I said to this young man, my, you're a very nice person, and it's a beautiful coat you're wearing. And I said, if my son had lived, this is the kind of coat that he would have worn. He said, really? And I said, I took a paper out, and I said, my son was Joe Beam. He says, I knew Joe Beam. There's a perfect stranger, but I'm everywhere I go, I talk about my son. The young man said, I knew Joe Beam.
It's obvious that your life has changed
a
lot.
Yes, ma'am.
Since your son died.
Yes.
Do you feel like you really have then embarked on a completely new chapter in your life? Or do you feel that you're sort of mixing things from your past and your old life and working them into your new life now?
No, I think that... you see, out of everything bad, something good happens. Now, if my son had not passed, I wouldn't even be involved with this. But here I was retiring from school. And see, everything worked out because I had retired from school. And then my son passed, which was a traumatic shock. But God gave me something else to do. So I feel that this is a challenge. This is the way God has prepared for me to go. And I just thank the Lord that my health is getting better. My nerves are calming down. And I can go places and do things. This was what God had prepared for me that I didn't even know about. I did not know I had to rise to the challenge of putting the book out, talking to parents, and helping parents to overcome their, because many of our young people, our young people are dying, and parents are trying to cope with that every day. I didn't know I would be a solace, a comfort to someone else. I had no idea, because I was looking for comfort myself. But now I have to help others.
Are you a different person because of all
this? Oh, my goodness, yes. Yes, I am. I think I'm a much better person.
Do you?
Yes, because I would have never thought of running around like this before. To comfort anybody, I would have sent a card, I would have sent maybe flowers, whatever I could have done, I would have, but I would not have gone to visit, and I wouldn't have called people on the phone and extended myself. And now I extend myself to everyone. I'd be away somewhere on a cruise, I would be doing something different. Really, I would, I really would not be around, and I would have, moved and got myself a condo. I would be living what you call the good life. But the good life is not always the best life. The good life is sometimes a boring life. This is better. I'm helping others.
Do you think that your son had any idea that you actually might be going through his material, his writings? He knew he was dying.
Oh, yes.
You
yes,
didn't
I had
know
that
he was
feeling.
Dying.
Yeah, yeah, I had
but
that
did,
feeling.
Did you think, since he saved everything, that he knew you were going to come and look through his stuff?
Yes, I would imagine. See, I was a teacher, and my son knew that I saved everything, too. I save every bits of paper. Teachers do that. So he would think to himself, if I save everything, I know my mother will go through. She's that kind of a mother, because she wants to know everything that's happening. Yes, he would say, yes, my mother would go through all this. And I told his dad, I said, if Joe is in heaven, and I feel that he is, he's smiling, he's looking down, smiling down, because he says to himself, I knew that my mother would carry on if anything happened to me, because he had that kind of a mother. I would carry on.
Well, I thank you so much, Dorothy Beam, for joining us today. Thank you. Dorothy Beam served as project manager for her late son's book, Brother to Brother, New Writings by Black Gay Men. Essex Hempel was the editor. The book is published by Allison Publications in Boston. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Sarah Paretsky is a woman who's made it big in the male domain of mystery writing. And she's created one of the best-known private eyes in the mystery world, V.I. Warshawski. Coming up, we talk with Sarah Paretsky. Also, commentator and college professor Maureen Corrigan checks out the latest weapon in the age-old battle between students who cheat on tests and the teachers who try to catch them. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Bush administration has come under congressional pressure over disputed loan guarantees to Israel. Secretary of State James Baker says that Washington will only back the $10 billion in guarantees if the Israelis freeze all construction of new settlements in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
Senator Patrick Leahy, chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on Foreign Operations, is the man caught between Israel's staunchest supporters and the Bush administration. Today, he told Secretary of State Baker, unless the administration agrees to accept a compromise, he could not push through the 1992 foreign aid bill. The bill was held up because of the loan guarantees in the fall. Foreign aid programs have been operating on stopgap funding. If there's no bill, the administration risks losing $150 million in new humanitarian and economic assistance for the former Soviet Union. Leahy says there's no point in pushing through something the Bush administration is going to veto. But President Bush told reporters today he does not intend to shift his policy. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan says that he is cautiously optimistic about the economy gaining strength. But he said the central bank is ready to lower interest rates again if it appears this is needed. Testifying today before the Senate Banking Committee, Greenspan said there are distinct financial indications of improvement at this time, including less debt and faster growth in the nation's money supply. At the same time, Greenspan warned this growth could peter out, as did an upswing last spring. Bush administration officials have asked Congress for another $55 billion to complete the bailout of depositors of the nation's failed savings and loans. Officials also outlined a new proposal to provide dying but not yet dead SNLs with taxpayer money. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
At the same time it is winding up work on the failed SNLs, the administration is considering a new plan that would use taxpayer dollars to shore up ailing but still in business SNLs. For the first time, the money would go to stockholders of the institutions, but lawmakers from both parties are skeptical of the idea. House Banking Committee Chairman Henry Gonzalez says there are better ways to waste money.
Going to go that way, my recommendation is that we go out to Las Vegas and hire the best bookie we can buy.
The administration plans to hold hearings on its proposal next month. Officials contend the plan could save taxpayers money in the long haul. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 24.5 points to close at 3,257.83, on volume of some 208 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 5-3. This is NPR News. A top World Bank official says the recent airlift of food to the former Soviet Union is the least useful kind of aid. Lawrence Summers, bank vice president, said that medical aid would have been more useful than food, since half the hospitals lack running water. Speaking today in Washington, Summers said the right plan for helping former Soviet states is to let prices rise, supply food to free markets, and use the money from sales to help the people who need it most. He said overall up to $25 billion should be spent to help the states that once made up the Soviet Union. Deposed Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide prepared to leave Washington this afternoon amid doubts over a recent agreement aimed at restoring democracy to his country. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Aristide has repeated his demand for the removal of Lieutenant General Raoul Cedras as part of an agreement toward returning democracy to Haiti. Cedras is the leader of the country's five-month-old military regime. However, an advisor to Prime Minister-designate René Theodore said today that Aristide had dropped his demand that Cedras be tried or sent into exile. In formal talks last weekend, Aristide had agreed with Haitian lawmakers to a general amnesty for those involved in September's coup, but it is unclear if the offer included Cedras. In private talks yesterday in Washington with Theodore, Aristide also expressed differences over how parts of the agreement could be interpreted, including the amnesty offer. The agreement reached between Aristide and Haiti's legislators calls for a new prime minister, reform of the army, and Aristide's return to Haiti. Meanwhile, the Haitian military has not indicated whether it will accept the agreement. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
President Bush has named five Southern California counties a federal disaster area because of heavy rainfall and flooding earlier this month. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. 10 years ago, Sarah Paretsky created a new kind of private detective. V.I. Warshawski is tough, hot-tempered, and independent, and she specializes in white-collar crime. She drinks Johnny Walker Black Label Scotch straight up, and she hates being called Vicky. Until the women's movement, it would have been difficult to imagine the kind of hard-boiled detectives that Paretsky and other female mystery writers have created, writers like Sue Grafton, Nancy Pickard, and Susan Wolfe. Paretsky's latest novel is called Guardian Angel, and it centers around a neighborhood that's getting yuppified. The newcomers, looking to improve the appearance of the place, are pressuring the old-time residents to clean up their yards. The worst offender is Hattie Frizzell, whose yard is a mess and whose dogs are considered a menace. As it turns out, V.I. Warshawski lives in this neighborhood, too. I asked Sarah Paretsky to read the opening page of Guardian Angel.
Hot kisses covered my face, dragging me from deep sleep to the rim of consciousness. I groaned and slid deeper under the covers, hoping to sink back into the well of dreams. My companion wasn't in the humor for rest. She burrowed under the blankets and continued to lavish urgent affection on me. When I covered my head with a pillow, she started to mew piteously. Now thoroughly awake, I rolled over and glared at her. It's not even 5:30. You can't possibly want to get up. She paid no attention, either to my words or my efforts to dislodge her from my chest, but looked at me intently, her brown eyes open wide, her mouth parted slightly to show the tip of her pink tongue. I bared my teeth at her. She licked my nose anxiously. I sat up, pushing her head away from my face. It was this indiscriminate distribution of your kisses that got you into this fix to begin with. Happy to see me awake, Peppy lumbered down from the bed and headed for the door. She turned to see if I was following, making little whimpering noises in her impatience. I pulled a sweatshirt and shorts from the heap of clothes near the bed and padded on sleep-thickened legs to the back door. I fumbled with the triple locks. By that time, Peppy was whimpering in earnest, but she managed to control herself while I got the door open. Breeding shows, I guess.
I love that opening to the book. And I was thinking, for someone that had no idea that your book is about a female detective, they would really be kind of bamboozled by that opening.
Well, I guess I was just having fun being a little bit naughty with that, because when I first started writing the books, my character, V.I., she does have affairs. She's not promiscuous. I mean, there's never more than one lover per book. And some people would write just absolutely furious. You know, they live for years with Spencer and Marlowe and all these men who sleep around a lot. But as soon as VI started doing it, it was just more than body and soul could take. And they would write and say, you know, I read this and I threw the book across the room so hard the spine broke. But then I heard from, they sort of sorted themselves out after the first two books. But over the years, I've gotten lots of letters from people who said, you know, why isn't there more sex in your books? And
so you showed them, like, right?
Right. You know, I think if you want to know how to do it, get a sex manual. But I just couldn't resist starting there with her.
Well, I must say, in this latest novel, it seems like V.I. is tired. She needs naps. She writes about being exhausted and tired. And I was wondering, too, as she approaches 40, is she beginning to feel her age?
I don't know. When you put it that way, it sounds as though she's beginning to feel my age is what happened to her. But yes, one of the issues that I need to sort out before I sit down and start the next book is how aging is going to affect her. And Guardian Angel really ends with her saying, when my muscles slow down, what other strengths will I find? And I don't know yet, but one of the things that I want to do, one of the things that keeps her interesting for me, is to age her as I age. And it makes an interesting challenge. And I don't have the answer. What will she find, a partner? Will she find other ways of solving problems? I've got to sort that out.
Well, the book is titled Guardian Angel, and yet she dreams. I mean, these are nightmares about abandonment. And I think of abandonment and old age, the kind of loneliness when people do leave because they have died. Is that a theme that you even personally are wrestling with?
Oh, yes. I think alienation and loneliness are perpetual themes for many people, and certainly for me. I mean, it's true that I'm married and very happily married. My husband is more than 20 years older than I am, and I think as I watch him, he doesn't seem like an old man, but he's in his late 60s. I start getting terrified about the prospect of life alone without him. I worry about his own diminishing strength, and I don't know. It's possible to be in love and happily married and still feel isolated and alienated, I suppose.
Well, you have some back problems yourself, and I wonder whether it seems from what I read about you that they are flaring up and that you are in some pain.
Well, when I was working on the early stages of Guardian Angel, my back was just an ordinary bothersome back until I got bad medical care.
Really?
And then I was almost permanently crippled. I was just very lucky to make the recovery that I did. And I think that was also on my mind as I was writing the book. I mean, I'm much better now than I was, but I know how frail that I am, or how frail certainly I can be.
In a recent article I read about you, you said that you hated your books. And this is a quote, "I always hate them, but I hate this one more." And that's referring to this latest book. Do you really hate your books?
I think that there's...
Is that going through a period of hating your books?
As I get more remote from them, I start to like them better. I find them more readable. When they first come out, the problem is it's really an issue of voice and voicelessness. And I'm going to just take a minute to explain this if you're interested.
Sure, go ahead.
I think that the struggle that I've always had throughout my life is needing to find a voice and needing to find the courage to speak. And I grew up in a time and place where women's lives, little girls' lives, were rather significantly devalued. And although I had written all my life, it took me a long time to get kind of the courage to write for publication. But I find somehow that I'm still shocked at hearing myself. When I read interviews, I think, you know, I've spoken too much, too strongly. And when I read what I've written, it in a way almost terrifies me to see it laid out there. And I almost need to jump back away from it.
I'm speaking with Sarah Paretsky, and for some 10 years now, or nearly 10 years now, she's been writing detective novels featuring her female detective, V.I. Warshawski, and her latest book is called Guardian Angel. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with writer Sarah Paretsky. I must ask you why you gave V.I. Warshawski the name Victoria Iphigenia Warshawski. And as I read that, I thought, boy, what parent would give their daughter a name like that?
Yeah, what cruel and inhuman.
To saddle her with a name like that.
I wanted my own last name is Polish, but I'm just abysmal with the ethnic origins of last names. I wanted to give V.I. a Polish last name, partly to reflect that part of my own ethnicity, but also because Chicago is a very sort of ethnically divided city. I would suspect probably only Boston is a place where people care as much about their racial or their ethnic backgrounds as they do in Chicago. So, you know, I just didn't know what would be a Polish name, what would be Croatian, what would be which. So I said, okay, Warsaw, that's in Poland, Warshawski, that's got to be Polish. Although, oh, never mind. I mean, then I found out some snot from the Slavic department at the University of Chicago cornered me at a party one night and said, well, you know, you've picked a last name of no definable place of national origin. And I said, well, it's Polish. And he said, well, not the way you've spelled it. And then it turns out that probably it's a Jewish name, which, you know, some Polish Americans then have been writing me hate mail telling me that I'm just a dirty Jew trying to defame the Polish nation. And so it's been kind of more trouble in a way than I ever anticipated.
Well, I'm curious what it's been like for you since the movie version of your work and with Kathleen Turner playing V.I. Warshawski. Did that contaminate at all your picture, your idea of a V.I.?
The process of making the movie made writing rather difficult at the time that I was doing it. Not so much because of Kathleen, but just the process was invasive. And it can be rather difficult. I minimized how much I had to do with the studio and with the production team when I realized that. But it's still, I think she's been such an intimate part of my life. V.I. has I don't know whether other writers feel this closely attached to characters that they create. I expect they do. When it's a series character, it's someone that you're living with for a very long time. I suddenly started feeling rather violated by having her taken over by other people. When the movie came out, though, and I went to see it, it's so different from what I do and from what I try to do that I felt a real sense of release. It gave the character back to me.
You started Sisters in Crime back in 1986, an organization for women mystery writers. Why did you start that organization then? Why did you think it was important that women mystery writers have their own group?
Sisters in Crime is really about women getting together to help women, although the organization is open to men, and we do have male members, and we do support their work as members, just as we do women's work. At the time that I and a handful of other women got together and started this, we were hearing a lot of issues about the way in which some writers felt that women's work was being devalued. In some ways, I suppose you could say the most serious was that books by women were significantly underrepresented in reviews. And this is important because libraries buy books based on whether they see reviews of them. So if your book isn't out there, it doesn't get bought. And libraries really make
the difference between whether you live or die as a new writer. What we found when we ran the numbers was that if you were a woman writing a mystery, or if you were a man writing a mystery, you were 7 times more likely to have your book reviewed than if you were a woman.
Is that because some of the male writers had a track record? Did that make a difference?
I think that one of the things that people look at is, oh gosh, I mean, you see this in the movies. If it's a Joan Crawford movie, it's a woman's movie. If it's a Western, it's a movie, you know. If you're doing something which is perceived as being masculine, it's perceived as being for everyone. If you do something which is perceived as being feminine, then you're just doing it for women. I think one reason that my books and that of the other writers doing hard-boiled work, like Sue Grafton or Linda Barnes and so on, why we've always gotten the attention we have is because we are doing something that's masculine. And so we're writing in a very male form. And so it's just taken more seriously, perhaps, than the work that some other writers are doing.
Did you see yourself, or do you see yourself as taking on, then, a male world?
Well, certainly in just choosing to show a woman doing a job which historically was closed to women, you are, to that extent, taking on a male world. You're also taking on certain kinds of stereotypes. If you look at mainstream American crime fiction, what you find is that women are almost always portrayed, I mean, who they are is defined by their sexuality. So that in Chandler, for instance, in 6 of his 7 novels, it's a beautiful, sexually active woman who causes everything that goes wrong. And that's a theme that continues to run through this kind of novel. Tom Tober wrote a book called Coda sometime in the mid-80s, and the opening sentence is, "The trouble began in bed." And we know when we read that this troublemaker is going to be our villain, and sure enough, she is. And we also see women are portrayed either directly as prostitutes or indirectly. I mean, they may be professionals like Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction, but they're unable to operate in any other way than as driven by and determined by their sexuality. So if you're going to stand up and say, I have a different vision of how women act and what drives them, then you are taking on just a whole raft of stereotypes.
Well, I regret to say we're out of time, but I thank you very much, Sarah Paretsky, for joining us today.
Well, glad to be here. Thanks, Marty.
Detective writer Sarah Paretsky's latest book is called Guardian Angel. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. Today we start a series on AIDS and Hispanics. Brenda Wilson reports today on AIDS and Central American refugees, people who left their native lands, fleeing one set of dangers, only to come to the U.S. and encounter some other dangers, including the possibility of being infected with the AIDS virus. Also today, we'll hear from reporter David Wellnup on the eve of the drug summit at which President Bush meets with the leaders of Mexico and 4 Andean countries about what's happened in the war on drugs since the last drug summit in 1990 in Cartagena, Colombia.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered, coming up from National Public Radio. We keep hearing about the dire state of American education and what our students don't know. But commentator Maureen Cargan says that a new book circulating on college campuses reveals that American students still have what it takes to be top in one academic discipline, cheating.
I'm giving a midterm in a few weeks to my freshman English classes. I used to think of exam days as mini vacations. I'd just drink coffee and read the newspaper, while my students would scribble illegible things into blue books for an hour. But after reading Michael Moore's book, Cheating 101, subtitled The Benefits and Fundamentals of Earning the Easy A, I know I've got to change my laid-back attitude. According to Moore, while professors like me are dozing at our desks, enterprising students are acing their exams by using foot signals,
crib sheets taped underneath their baseball caps, and hidden Walkmans that play doctored tapes of the test material. Against this arsenal, the only way a professor can ensure that students don't cheat is to give them the Hannibal the Cannibal treatment, straitjacket them, and lock them into isolation chambers during the test. Michael Moore is a junior journalism major at Rutgers University. In a recent interview with the New York Times, he said he got the idea for his book last October when he witnessed fellow students flagrantly cheating on a physical geography exam. Moore used his Macintosh computer to write and publish Cheating 101. The book costs about $7. You can buy it through mail order, no, I'm not going to advertise the address, or from student representatives on college campuses across the country. In the past 2 months, Moore claims his newly formed publishing company has grossed approximately $20,000. That's more than a lot of adjunct college instructors make in an entire year. Cheating 101 is filled with sophomoric humor and craven homages to super cheaters like Richard Nixon and Joe Biden. But I had to admire the ingenuity of some of Moore's exam scams. For instance, here's how Moore describes his strategy against the dreaded essay test. Tony, a fictitious student at UCLA, goes to a psychology midterm. He pretends to take the exam, but he really spends the hour writing down the questions, not the answers, in his blue book. When the period is over, Tony hands in a dummy blue book. Then he goes back to his dorm and takes the test, with the help of his psychology textbooks. When he's finished, Tony drops this blue book on a path near the professor's office. Then he has a friend, preferably a sweet-voiced woman, make this phone call. I quote, "Professor Evil, you don't know me, but I found a blue book from one of your tests on the ground outside Lewis Hall." "Really?" Professor Evil replies. "I must have dropped it after the exam. Where can I pick it up?" "There you have it," says Moore, "a guaranteed A." Moore is clever about something else, too. He knows these tips work because most professors don't want to discover cheaters. The prosecution process is a time-consuming hassle, especially if a student retaliates with a lawsuit. I know I've always preferred to believe my students have had something in their eyes rather than think they were blinking answers in Morse code to each other. But now Moore has gotten me and other teachers mad, which is probably what he wanted. The upshot is that his book sales will double. In addition to eager students snapping up Cheating 101, their suspicious professors will be buying and studying it too.
Maureen Cargan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller with Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Roberta Shorrock, and Joan Tui. Our research assistant is Ellen Silva. I'm Artie Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, we meet the man who wrote the music for Disney's Beauty and the Beast and The Little Mermaid, Alan Menken. He also did the music for the play Little Shop of Horrors. That and more on the next Fresh Air.